Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to February's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I am delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Specialist in Small Animal Internal Medicine, Jenny Helm. Thank you, Jenny. I am now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Ema, and welcome to our talk this afternoon. What I'd like to talk to you about is an update on canine lungworm in the UK. As part of my introduction, I'd just like to run through what we're going to talk about today. So I'd like to start off with which lungworm affect dogs in the UK, move on to an overview of the clinical presentation and an introduction, think about diagnostics and what kind of clinical plans we'll have, and then focus a little bit on Androstrongylus fusarium, and I'll tell you why in a second. Then moving on to a risk-based approach to the use of anthelmintics. Now, it's useful to say that I am a clinician, as Ema mentioned. I am a specialist in small animal medicine, and I currently spend a lot of my time in the oncology clinics at the University of Glasgow. I am, however, married to a GP vet, so I understand some of the challenges that GP vets face when prescribing anthelmintics and talking to dog owners about lungworm in the UK. We do have a wee dog where you'll see pictures throughout this presentation of our dog, Rosie, so I understand a little bit of the perspective of a dog owner, and also we have small children, so I understand, as being a mum, what it's like to worry about parasites in small children as well. I developed an interest in canine lungworm about 10 years ago now, when I found one of the first cases of Androstrongylus fusarium in Scotland, and that sparked a research interest, and since then I've done a fair bit of research in Androstrongylus fusarium, particularly with Eric Morgan at the University of Bristol. But I'm not a parasitologist or a veterinary parasitologist, so it may be that some questions that I get at the end of this presentation, I do pass on to colleagues who might be able to answer those better from a parasitologist point of view. So starting with the lungworm that we might encounter in the UK, we can see Chronozoma vulpis, Phyllaroides oslowi, which was previously named Oslous oslowi, Phyllaroides hirthi, and of course, as mentioned, Androstrongylus fusarium. So with Chronozoma vulpis, what might we see? Well, this lungworm is not as high profile as Androstrongylus, but it does have a very similar life cycle, that of a metastrongyloid parasite, which involves the fox as a common final host and slugs and snails as intermediate hosts. It is widespread in the UK already, even from the very earliest clinical studies, Chronozoma vulpis was found to be widespread within the UK. And clinical signs are largely respiratory, so here it differs from Androstrongylus. We don't see the coagulopathies that we'll mention with Androstrongylus. We see primarily respiratory signs. And signs can be very severe with Chronozoma vulpis, or they can be very mild. So we might see just a cough, might see very severe cough and dyspnea. If the disease is untreated and becomes chronic, then we may in fact see a chronic cough with time. It's also possible for dogs to be asymptomatic carriers and therefore carry infection for other dogs and for the life cycle to be perpetuated and to continue. Chronozoma vulpis is diagnosed definitively by finding larvae or adults in bronchoalveolar lavage fluid or on fecal examination using the Behrmann technique. Now, often Chronozoma vulpis, they're not as numerous or as vigorous as Androstrongylus fusarium, but they are certainly morphologically distinct, so they have a much straighter larval tail. We may also see larvae on bronchoscopy, as this picture highlights at the top of my slide, and we might also see erythema, inflammation, and a discharge on bronchoscopy as well. Likely to see eosinophils on bronchoalveolar lavage or tracheal wash specimens. Moving on to Phyllaroides oslowi, again, this is relatively widespread in the UK. Adult worms inhabit nodules at the base of the trachea, and what's different about Phyllaroides oslowi is it does have a direct life cycle. So mostly transmission is dog to dog, so outbreaks in kennels are more common, or where dogs are in close contact. One of the main mechanisms of transfer dog to dog is thought to be from mothers to their pups through sputum. So it is a very different life cycle to that of Chronozoma and Androstrongylus fusarium. Clinical signs again are respiratory in nature, may include lethargy and coughing, and a major differential would be kennel cough with an outbreak of this lungworm within a kennel situation. It's also been documented as a cause of poor race performance in greyhounds, again because those dogs are housed in close contact. Sometimes you're more likely to get an outbreak in those breeds. Filariides oslii has quite a characteristic appearance on bronchoscopy, so we can see nodules at the base of the trachea, just at the tracheal bifurcation. Interestingly, regarding treatment, surgical removal of these nodules is not recommended, and treatment is focused on fenbendazole and Filariides oslii. It is the licensed treatment for Filariides oslii. Definitive diagnosis, again, is made by finding larvae on faecal Behmen or zinc flotation examination, but you may also see larvae or eggs when you're taking samples, bronchoalveolar lavage samples or tracheal wash samples, or even in this case on sputum samples as well. Filariides hirthi is another lungworm that you may encounter, again, widely distributed globally. Relatively uncommon and rarely diagnosed clinically, actually, so you're much more likely to see one of those cases of the earlier worms that I've mentioned. With this parasite, dogs may remain healthy, but others, particularly those that are immunosuppressed, may develop severe or even fatal disease. Again, clinical signs tend to be respiratory in nature, focusing on coughing and dyspnea. And in these cases, actually, fenbendazole was not successful in the literature at clearing Filariides hirthi. Therefore, albendazole is the recommended treatment. I've had a look and I couldn't find a small animal preparation of albendazole. So I'd be interested if any of the audience out there have used it in small animals. I've certainly found on the VMD website many cattle and sheep preparations that are available and could be used as this indication through the veterinary cascade. So Andrew's Jungla's Visorum, we're going to come back to in some detail. I'd like to come back to it because it is potentially life-threatening. Therefore, I think it's important that we know how to recognise this lungworm, that we know how it differs from those other lungworms that I've mentioned, and so that we can treat it and prevent it effectively. It is a metastrongyloid parasite, primarily affects wild and domestic dogs. So our final host is the dog, or in this country, the fox. Lungworm or French heartworm are terms that are often used for Andrew's Jungla's Visorum. It shouldn't be confused with Dirofilaria immitus, which is a true heartworm, but is not found in this country at present. There is increased awareness and potentially increased prevalence, and I'm going to come back to that and see what we think about that and whether we feel that it is just overhype or whether we do truly have an emerging parasitic disease in Andrew's Jungla's Visorum. So what do we think about the clinical approach to these lungworm cases? Well, really, it centres on, as with any sick animal, having a case or problem-based approach. So as soon as we're out of our comfort zone of seeing routine consultations and healthy pets for preventative pet care, such as vaccinations, that type of thing, then when we have an animal that's sick, it really helps to have a really structured and logical approach to investigation. These cases tend to be cardiorespiratory cases presenting with cough or dyspnea, with the exception of Andrew's Jungla's Visorum, which we will come back to. So what is a problem-based approach? I'm sure most of you will have heard this before. Certainly it's something that we teach our students as to make them as methodical as possible. So we start off in our heads thinking about the patient identification or the signalment. So how does that give us clues as to what might be wrong with our patient? Then obviously taking a detailed history, performing a full clinical exam will help, and then formulating a problem list. So we basically can come up with the problems that we're seeing in the consult room, coming up with some differential diagnoses for those problems, and then thinking about further tests that would be useful, hopefully coming to a diagnosis, and then implementing the correct treatment and supportive management. So we'll use Andrew's Jungla's as an example to go through this, but let's focus down on it a little bit more at this introductory stage. So patient signalments, what might we see? Well, primarily dogs affected with lungworm do tend to be young animals, and immunocompromised animals, as I've mentioned earlier, may be more likely to be affected and may have more severe disease. Certainly, if you've got an outbreak in kennels or closed housing, you would start to think about Filariides oslii as being a top differential for those patients. I say young animals, but certainly we'll come back to this with Andrew's Jungla's. It can also be older animals. So bear in mind, all animals, all ages, all breeds are at risk, but young animals are going to shift lungworm up your differential list. Clinical presentation. Well, of course, we do our detailed history. and our clinical examination, focusing on our history, whether we've got any of those risk factors. Perhaps we've got a dog that's known to eat slugs and snails, might be a risk factor. A dog that is in an area where we're seeing lots of lungworm, a dog in kennel situation when we're seeing Filariides oslii. So that our history is very important. Knowing what our pets have been wormed with is also important, because some of our more common wormers won't prevent lungworm. So we need to be aware of the worming history as well. Then we perform our clinical examination, and on thoracic auscultation, we might hear a variety of abnormal noises. So possible to hear wheezes and crackles, harsh lung sounds, and upper respiratory tract noise in some cases as well. So important to perform our full clinical presentation, full clinical examination. With angiostrongylus vasorum, we might be looking a little bit outside the cardiorespiratory system, and we'll come back to this, how we may see bleeding disorders, how we may see neurological disorders, and other more unusual presentations. Once we've done our history, our physical exam will come up with a problem list, which likely with lungworm might include things like a cough, dyspnea, lethargy. And from that, we'll come up with our differential diagnoses, which a definition is there for you on the slide to say that we're basically coming up with some conditions which may account for those clinical signs. Now, sadly, with a problem like a cough, we have a variety of differential diagnoses. And basically, obviously, you'll be putting together the pieces from the history, from the physical exam, and some of these will be ruled out immediately. So you may have no evidence of heart failure, you may have no heart murmur, no tachycardia present. You may have no evidence of electrocution, for example, which is just down the bottom there for pulmonary edema. So you will be able to quickly tick some of these off your differential list, but it's likely in the initial stages that you might be left with parasites as a possible differential for a number of these patients that you're dealing with. So regarding parasites at this point, I often get asked the question as, what's the next step? Can we just do trial treatment? Will we just rule out lungworm at this stage by treating it? And yeah, for sure, that's possible, but there are a few limitations. Or do we move on to further tests and do we try and establish if lungworm is the correct diagnosis in our patients? So trial treatment, why do I say ideally not? And I think this is a view that's shared by a lot of parasitologists too. Well, if you just trial treat and your patient gets better, they may well have had lungworm, but you don't have a confirmed idea of the true prevalence at your local level. So you don't know how much lungworm you're seeing through your practice, and therefore you don't really know how much emphasis you should place on prevention of lungworm within your practice implementation plans. Whereas if you're testing for lungworm and you're getting lots of negatives, you might come to the conclusion that actually lungworm isn't a huge issue for us because we keep testing and we never see it. It might be you start testing for it and you see lots of lungworm. So you therefore know that you need to include a prophylactic plan for lungworm in your practice pack. So it's really, if you do trial treatment, you might never find out what your local level of risk is. Also, it's difficult if the patient doesn't respond to treatment, then is it a resistant lungworm, or do you have a complicating factor there? So it becomes a bit complex when you haven't made a diagnosis to know exactly what the situation is in the individual patient as well. Obviously, in some clients, it's the only option to treat because they can't afford further diagnostics. And of course, I would support that if it's not possible for them to afford to undergo to have their patient take fecal samples for a Behmen analysis, for example, or even run one of the tests, the blood tests that we'll talk about later for angiostrongylus. Sometimes if you have a patient very severely affected, especially with angiostrongylus, you may elect to treat and follow up very promptly with tests, so you're not delaying treatment while you're waiting for tests to come back. And a lot of vets I know do that. So they treat for angio and then they collect feces very quickly. Hello, everybody. I hope that you can hear me back now. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened to a technical issue there, but I am back with you. So we were talking about trial treatment and I was saying ideally not, because we don't understand what the local level of risk is if we don't start testing our patients for lungworm, and also we don't understand about the individual patient as well and how we manage the individual patient to the best of our abilities. So moving on from there, as I mentioned before the sound cut out, we may elect to treat and follow up promptly with diseases like angiostrongylus vasorum, where we have a very severe disease process and we don't want to withhold treatment until we have results back. So with our focus moving on to Angiostrongylus physorum, what is this parasite? Well, we've already said it's a metastrongyloid parasite, primarily affects wild and domestic dog species. So the fox is a wildlife reservoir in this country, and it's sometimes termed lungworm, French heartworm, or small heartworm. And it's not to be confused with the heartworm Dirofilaria immitus. It is potentially life-threatening, and that's why I thought I would focus on it. I also was getting a few comments from vets that I meet across the country that is Angiostrongylus physorum been overhyped? Is this really a concern to us type questions? So to recap the life cycle for Angiostrongylus, dogs are the final host and the fox is the wildlife reservoir. Just going to try get a little arrow up on the screen if I can here. Yeah. So basically, we have larvae, L3 larvae, entering the dog as they're swallowed. They may be swallowed by eating slugs and snails, but it may also be recent evidence might be emerging that larvae can survive in stagnant water, such as puddles, or maybe on vegetation for a little while. So it may be that they're not known slug and snail eaters, but they pick them up from vegetation or from stagnant water. Those larvae then come through the gastrointestinal tract. They migrate through the lymphatics, through the liver here, and into the heart, where they mature into adults and lay eggs. And we see the larvae, the L1 larvae penetrating through the lungs, causing pathology as they go, and they are coughed and swallowed and passed in the feces. Those L1 larvae require the slug and snail to be transformed into L3 larvae, and the cycle continues basically. Frogs are known as peritenic hosts. This means that the larvae can survive in frogs, but they don't change life stage within the frog. So we will just move on from our life cycle to talk about what's happening in the UK. So, question, is this overhyped? So we've got lots of newspaper articles. Often the terminology is quite dramatic. So killer parasite found to be endemic across Scotland, a campaign that I was involved in at speaking about this when some of our research was released last September. We've got, this is a link to an advert at the top there, which you can watch an advert aimed at pet owners about the dangers of Angiostrongylus physorum. And then this is another newspaper article looking at how the killer parasite could be more prevalent in foxes. So certainly we know from our veterinary literature that there are new endemic areas of Angiostrongylus physorum. Certainly Scotland, where I've been involved, is a new area of AV, but there's been a shift, we think, from the southwest to more cases been abundant in the southeast of England now. And we've got increased awareness. So we've got increased media awareness, increased pharmaceutical companies getting involved, doing their television adverts or their newspaper adverts. And we're doing CPD about lungworm. So this isn't the only talk, of course, that I've done over my career. I've done other talks about lungworm, and we're spreading the word about lungworm. So are we overhyping Angiostrongylus physorum? There's more studies out there for sure, and we've got new novel bedside blood tests available to us. So, is it overhyped or is there a true increase in Angiostrongylus physorum? Well, why don't we ask the foxes? Because foxes, as Eric Morgan said down at Bristol, they don't do CPD. So, they don't know that there's increased hype. They don't know that we're all talking about Angiostrongylus. They just do what they do. They're the wildlife reservoir and they pick up the disease if the disease is there. So, they're not affected by confounding factors. And there's been a couple of studies looking at postmortems, opportunistic postmortems on fox carcasses. And what those studies showed that back in 2005, 2006, lots of foxes were sampled in the north of England and Scotland, but none of these foxes were positive for angio. So north of Birmingham, at this stage, we didn't have any Angiostrongylus physorum in the foxes that were sampled as part of this study. Yet quite a few years later, about 8 years later, we saw that a number of these foxes sampled were positive. So we've got a positive up in Scotland, we've got plenty of positives in the northwest of England, and some positives down sort of east Yorkshire way, down in the northeast of England as well. So the foxes gave us strong evidence for the northward spread of Angiostrongylus physorum in the UK. So this isn't simply overhype, there actually is true emergence of this parasite. And in Scotland, we reported our initial case back in 2008. 2015, we published our study looking at slugs and snails. And again, slugs and snails also don't do CPD, so they just pick up the disease when it's there, when they come across it. And we found 6.7% of slugs and snails were positive for Angio larvae in three Glasgow parks, and that was up to 11% in one Glasgow park. So although I think it's important that we put this all in perspective, we certainly do have some good scientific evidence that Angio strongylus visorum is on the increase. So why has that happened? Why has disease spread? Well, it's pretty much going to be the right move at the right time. So we know that we've got dog and fox movement. We know that people might go on holiday from London up to the lakes or vice versa, taking their dog with them in the car. And if they happen to have Angio strongylus and they shed larvae at that time, if we've got a good habitat suitability, maybe climate change does play a small role. We've got ample intermediate hosts. We've certainly had some quite mild winters, so plenty of slugs and snails. Then if the parasite moves at the right time, then it will establish at that point. So we assume that's what's happened, as the parasite has set up in new endemic hotspots. So moving back to the disease in dogs, do we have any risk factors? Well, yes, location is still a risk factor, although we certainly see the parasite throughout the UK. There are areas which are overrepresented. So the southeast of England certainly seems to see quite a lot of cases. The far north of Scotland doesn't see very many. We know that young dogs are at risk. So dogs less than 18 months old are generally at risk, but disease in older dogs does occur. So dogs of all ages and all breeds are at risk. Dog behaviour is also under further investigation. So colleagues at the University of Bristol, I think, are looking at this currently, because we do know that dogs don't have to be slug or snail eaters to pick up the parasites. And seasonality is a bit of a weak link, possibly more disease in spring and summer. This is something that's certainly been investigated. So clinical signs, this is where Angio strongylus visorum differs from other lungworms. So of course we can see our cardiorespiratory signs, and certainly the majority of cases do have cardiorespiratory signs, our coughs, our dyspnea, harsh lung sounds, exercise intolerance. But we can also see a coagulopathy with Angio strongylus visorum, and we'll come back to this in a second. We can also see neurological signs, and these signs may occur in combination with cardiorespiratory signs, or they can occur in isolation. So you may have a dog present purely with neurological signs or purely with a coagulopathy. We can also see ocular signs too. There are rare clinical presentations also reported. So we can see hemoabdomen, hemothorax, gastric dilatation is reported, thought to be secondary to aerophagia, and pulmonary hypertension, cor pulmonale, is also reported. There was an experimental case which suffered from exsanguination due to a ruptured femoral artery. Obviously a very extreme situation. That was an experimental dog in Brazil, where they do give these dogs a high larval burden to investigate a variety of aspects of the disease. Larvae in adults have also been found in the anterior chamber of the eye, and I will show you a picture of that in a second. And very recently, a dermatitis case was reported in the Journal of Veterinary Dermatology, secondary to Angio strongylus visorum larval migrans. So there's certainly a very diverse clinical presentation. And this is a picture from one of our colleagues, our cardiologist Paul Wootton, showing larvae in the anterior chamber from a case when he worked down in Bristol. Really interesting photograph. So diagnostics. We can certainly start with blood tests and diagnostic imaging, although they won't give us pathognomonic changes. I will describe to you what we might see with Angio strongylus visorum, and then we can move on to more conformational tests. Or we may choose to start with conformational tests, in fact, to actually find out if we've got Angio strongylus visorum. Certainly would be a more economical way of approaching these cases. So common clinical findings, we can see a coagulopathy, and we will move on and I'll discuss this in a bit more detail in a second. We'll see a high globulin in about 75% of cases, and also an eosinophilia in about 50% of cases. Less common clinical findings would be an anemia, often regenerative if it's secondary to blood loss, and we might see that in about a third of cases. Hypercalcemia is also possible. Low serum fructosamine was reported, although I'm not sure how clinically relevant this is. And proteinuria is also reported. just over there. I've just shown you just for interest. I wouldn't say that you would run a serum protein electrophoresis, but interestingly, the high globulin is usually a beta 2 spike, so it's not as polyclonal as you would expect. And I'm sure that you're aware that some of the infectious diseases can give you a monoclonal gammopathy, which might be an important differential for neoplasia. So the coagulopathy, I think, for me is very interesting. One of my interests, and before I came across angiostrongylus, was hematological cases. So I find this aspect particularly interesting. Angiostrongylus usually causes a DIC, or a disseminated intravascular coagulation. It's thought to do this, although nobody knows 100% how it does this, through triggering antiplatelet antibodies by doing this with parasite antigens and proteins that trigger antiplatelet antibodies, and also by direct endothelial disruption. A secondary immune-mediated thrombocytopenia is also reported, as is a case of an acquired von Willebrand's factor deficiency, and a decrease in factor 5 and factor 8 is reported in a previous JSAP paper. So what is DIC? Well, it's a systemic coagulation problem linked to coagulation and fibrinolysis. In the initial stages, it causes thrombosis and then laterally bleeding. And it's due to the widespread endothelial damage, and also that causes release of tissue thromboplastins. It is a spectrum disorder over time, and I will show you this in the next slide. So basically, when we've got very early DIC, we start off and our bodies may be able to compensate for this. So we start to see here endothelial damage, cascade stimulation, and our patients are often hypercoagulable at this time, and we might not see any evidence of bleeding. As this progresses, we see ongoing coagulation, and we see consumption of clotting factors. We're using up those, we're using up fibrinogen, we're using up platelets, and we get an increase in these products called D-dimers and FDPs, which are products of clot breakdown. Laterally, as the process progresses over time, we start to see bleeding because we're using up all of our clotting factors, we're using up all of our platelets, and we at this stage get our hypocoagulable state. So at this stage, we're actually becoming hypocoagulable. Things have got a lot worse. This is the stage where we start to get very, very worried. So what you might see clinically on your clotting tests is you might see an increase in clotting times, APTT first and then PT usually later. You might see a thrombocytopenia because, as I said, those platelets are getting used up. You might see a low fibrinogen because, as I said, fibrinogen is getting used up. You might see high FDPs and D-dimers, and you might even see some schistocytes as red blood cells travel through damaged endothelial tissue. There's some examples down here of some schistocytes. Just get my little arrow back again, just to show you that these are damaged red blood cells. So this is what you might start to see on a blood smear, and you might start to see that you're not seeing as many platelets here and here as you would expect to see. What are FDPs and D-dimers? Well, I've already mentioned they're a product of clot breakdown. So as with DIC, you're making lots of little clots. Eventually, these clots break down and they produce FDPs and D-dimers. And there's a blood test which can measure FDPs and D-dimers for you. Very useful if they're negative. Usually, if they're negative, it means your patient doesn't have DIC in most cases. But they're not completely specific for DIC. So obviously, if you've had recent trauma and recent surgery, it's very normal for your body to form clots, or for your patient's body to form clots. So finding FDPs and D-dimers in patients that have liver disease, neoplasia, trauma, or recent surgery, then that would also be expected. So they can be tricky if they're positive, trying to pin down if it's due to DIC or not. So that's a little touch on DIC, and as I say, angiostrongylus certainly causes coagulopathies, and DIC is thought to be by it one of the main mechanisms which it causes a coagulopathy. Moving on to our diagnostic imaging, which you may of course choose to do if you have a coughing patient. So what might you see? Well, on your pulmonary thoracic radiographs, you might see bronchial thickening. Often your radiographic pattern starts quite peripheral, quite patchy, quite alveolar, and with time it progresses to a more bronchial diffuse interstitial pattern. It may be multifocal, or it could be, as I said, peripheral. As I say, those early stages tend to be more peripheral and laterally becoming more diffuse. We've started to review some CT images. So on CT scan, you will also see pulmonary changes if you're doing a thoracic CT. Again, you'll often see peripheral distribution. Often many lung lobes are affected on CT. and you will see a diffuse pattern as the disease progresses, we think. You may choose to do abdominal ultrasound or thoracic ultrasound if you suspect there's fluid or a hemothorax, hemoabdomen, for example. You may choose to do echocardiography if there are, if you see problems with the heart and you're thinking about pulmonary hypertension or some changes there. But usually it is actually chest radiographs which are the mainstay of the diagnostic imaging for these cases. So here's an example of a thoracic radiograph showing you the quite central bronchial alveolar pattern here. And this is interesting. This is a case which had angiostrongylus visorum, but in some ways could be mistaken for cardiac pulmonary edema because it is quite perihilar in its location. Over here is one of our CT scans showing the changes which are quite peripheral within the lung fields here and here, often described as a ground glass appearance on CT scan. But how do we actually make a diagnosis? And as I say, maybe I've actually got this the wrong way around. Maybe we should be making a diagnosis and we can do those supporter tests, because now we have the luxury of having a test called the AngioDetect blood test, which is very quick and very easy to use. So I've been encouraging vets that I speak to have this in your practice, because it really does give you a true idea in your coughing dogs and your bleeding dogs if you are seeing angiostrongylus or whether you're seeing other diseases. Because of course there are, as we mentioned, lots of differentials for a cough. There are similarly lots of differentials for coagulopathies as well. So I don't want to overhype. As I said, the media might be doing angiostrongylus, so I want to make sure that that you're testing for it and that you don't miss something that might be more common, like neoplasia or heart failure in an older patient. You will also be familiar with the fact that we can take fecal samples. We normally recommend that you would take fecal samples over 3 days. These can be refrigerated and pooled at the end of 3 days. That helps with the risk with fecal samples that we might have intermittent larval shedding. So taking a one-off sample can be sometimes problematic. And those would be sent away for a modified Behrmann, or you can actually learn to do Behrmann in-house. I'm not sure if there's anyone out there doing it, but certainly it's a test that can be done in your own practice laboratory. You may choose to do a direct fecal smear. We'll come back to that. With cardiovascular signs, you may choose to do a bronchoalveolar lavage. And with neurological signs, perhaps a more typical neurological workup might be indicated. And there are newer techniques, but these are not commercially available at the moment. And in acute infections, it's important to bear in mind that you might not see larval shedding immediately. So you might want to think about something like a bronchoalveolar lavage, which will you'll get to see the larvae there before they appear in the faeces. So a direct fecal smear, just an example of what you might see, just using a glove finger, smearing some feces on a glass slide, a little bit of saline just to suspend the feces, glass cover slide over the top. And in the case that we had back in 2008, this is how we had an initial suspicion for angiostrongylus, because we saw lots of abundant larvae on a direct fecal smear. And at the end, you can see the characteristic dorsal spine, a little curly kink tail, and the dorsal spine at the end. Sorry, I need to get my little green arrow just to highlight that over here. And as I say, I'm not a parasitologist, but I have got quite adept at recognising these larvae from other lung one that you may see. Again, a really nice picture here, courtesy of Eric Morgan, showing you the kink tail and the dorsal spine and the little notch here. Over here, we've got an adult worm in a fox that was found by one of our pathologists. So we can see the typical barber's pole appearance of the adult angiostrongylus here in a fox lung. So this is a slide to indicate how to use the AngioDetect. I'm pretty sure that people out there will be using it, but it's very, very simple. You can run it on plasma or serum. The test is kept in, doesn't need to be refrigerated, so it can be kept on a practice shelf. Basically, you take your equipment, you place 3 drops of your plasma or serum in the well, as indicated. You then hold the buffer solution upright and you place 3 drops of buffer solution in the sample well. You wait for 15 minutes and then you read your test. In this case, we've got a negative test. So basically, we can see just here that we've got one line showing that the test has worked. This is our control line. And over here, it's very difficult to make out in the picture, but there's a little T and that's a test line. So if you see a positive here, a line there, you've got a positive case. So confirming a diagnosis has been made very easy and very rapid and very cheap to do in practice using the AngioDetect, but you should bear in mind it's not 100% sensitive or specific. And then the studies used to evaluate AngioDetect before it became commercially available, it was compared to a fecal Behrmann as a gold standard. And of course, fecal Behrmann isn't really a gold standard. A gold standard would be to perform post-mortem examination and check for the disease, but that's not feasible in real life. So it's possible with the AngioDetect and also with the fecal Behrmann that you might get false negatives, but nevertheless a positive is a very, very useful result and is very, very reliable with both the AngioDetect and the fecal Behrmann. We are nearly there, running through our AngioStrong Dysphasorum and moving on to our worming, because I know everyone's on their lunch break trying to get back to work. So essentially we were talking about confirming a diagnosis. AngioDetect, brilliant, easy, rapid and cheap, but no test is 100% sensitive or specific. So false negatives could be a problem, particularly because it is compared to the fecal Behrmann as gold standard. And fecal Behrmann can't really be a gold standard because, of course, post-mortem examination would be. So it's probably not 100% sensitive or specific. It doesn't claim to be, but false negatives could be a problem, both with the AngioDetect and also the fecal Behrmann. But if we have a positive, it's a very reliable result and very useful to us. Fecal Behrmann main downside is it's a bit more finickety, should be run over 3 days because it might be affected by intermittent shedding. So it can be difficult as well, getting faeces from a patient which is very sick, maybe not eating very much. So fresh fecal smear, again, easy and very rapid, but it is very user dependent to actually detect the larvae and to diagnose the larvae correctly to rule out free living nematodes, for example. Bronchoscopy and BAL may pick up positive cases in acute infections prior to L1 appearing in the faeces, but it is risky, does involve an anaesthetic and is costly and is not readily available. Newer molecular techniques are coming out and I think they'll be great when they're available, but they're not commercially out there right now. So we confirm our diagnosis with compatible clinical signs, finding L1 in faeces or the pulmonary tree, or having a positive AngioDetect blood test. They should be distinguished, of course, from other lungworms. Mainly craniosoma vulpus would be a top differential. And should I treat when I have a clinical suspicion? Well, we touched on this earlier. I would prefer not to recommend that. I would prefer that you get a diagnosis and understand about the local level of risk and the individual patient diagnosis as well. How do we treat AngioStrongylus? Well, those items that are starred on this slide are the drugs that are licensed to treat AngioStrongylus visorum. So we've got imodacloprid, moxidectin, spoton, or milbemycin, oxime. Fenbendazole is frequently used, but it's actually not licensed, so shouldn't be used on the veterinary cascade. Moxidectin, imodacloprid, as I mentioned, kills our adults, our larvae, our L4 and our L5, whereas milbemycin oxime has a slightly different label claim to reduce the level of adults in L5. So you may wish to make decisions based on having a look at the data sheets. This is a slide just to give you some examples. You may be more familiar with trade names than actual drug names or the compound that is within the worming products that you're seeing on your shelves. I've just listed some trade names here and they are just examples. Please check all the up-to-date licensing information because not all of these products will have label claims for AngioStrongylus visorum, but I just wanted to give you some examples. I certainly know that Milbemax does have a label claim, so does Advocate, so does Prinivox, but it would be useful checking most up-to-date information for the rest of those. Supportive care is of course important. Some of these patients are critically ill at the time of presentation. So IV fluid therapy, rest, transfusion medicine when we have coagulopathies, respiratory signs, patients may require oxygen, bronchodilators, and quite often corticosteroids because the larvae migrating through the lungs does set up quite a severe inflammatory immune-mediated reaction sometimes. So corticosteroids at anti-inflammatory doses can be very useful, but we don't tend to need to use immunosuppressive doses of corticosteroids. We don't worry so much about anaphylaxis with our modern anthelmintics. It was often older anthelmintics like levimazole, which caused rapid worm killing, that were a major problem. So we'll keep going. We've only got a few slides left, and we'll see how we get on. So supportive care, we've covered important to provide supportive care for these patients. I'm often asked about antibiosis, and the truth is we don't know how many of these patients have a secondary bacterial component, but probably not. So I would recommend you treat the lungworm and only use antibiotics when you need to. treatment of DIC. This is where it differs from DIC caused by cancer and all those nasty things. We can actually eliminate the initiating cause with angius jugulus, so we can have a much better prognosis than when we think of DIC in the traditional terms, where at vet school I was taught it meant death is coming. So we also ensure adequate tissue perfusion, of course, support our target organs, replace blood components, and provide heparin if we need to, in the early stages, but that's sometimes to detect those very early stages because we don't have bleeding at that point in time. Outcome. I think it's important to say here that the veterinary literature is probably biased towards the more complex cases, because a lot of the literature comes out of referral hospitals. So probably in practice, a lot of our dogs can do very well with angius jugulus visorum. So if supported and treated correctly, dogs can make a complete recovery, especially in the primary care setting. So that's why I want to raise awareness so that this disease can be treated, can be recognised and treated promptly. So we have a few available client education options, and I'll move on to these in a few more details here. So give general advice, recommend responsible pet ownership. Lifting dog's feces is important, but you won't get all of the feces up. There will be still some contamination to the soil, and we can't effectively control the wildlife reservoir. Therefore, the only way to break the cycle is to implement an effective anti-worm plan. So ask the right questions, spend time with your clients, find out, is there a risk of lungworm? What else are they doing? Do they have young children? Are they worried about toxocara? Do they come into contact with people who are immunosuppressed? Do they eat slugs or snails? So just spend time with your clients, find out what the risk is at a local level. Slugs and snails, really, really important to say at this point, make sure owners don't think that they can kill slugs and snails and prevent this problem. Killing slugs and snails is dangerous using snail bait, which may be problematic to dogs, of course. And also by killing slugs and snails, we might increase the risk of L3 being released into the environment. So obviously tell them to try and avoid behavior where they're eating slugs and snails, but actually using slug or snail bait is dangerous, neither feasible or effective. Okay, everybody, so finally, moving on, we've got frequency of worming. So it's important here for lungworm, for angius jugulus visorum, that we worm every 4 to 6 weeks. So we can't just do the 3 months that are recommended for other worms. Other factors might mean that you're worming more frequently anyway. So finally, in summary, and once again, sorry for any technical issues during this presentation, all canine lungworm can be significant. Angius jugulus visorum is potentially very significant because it's life-threatening and it is spreading. So bear it in mind with your patients with respiratory signs and also those with coagulopathies or neurological signs. And please spend time educating clients about the risks and choose effective anti-worm strategies based on risk factors. So keep testing your animals, keep looking for lungworm, and obviously let me know if you find lungworm, if you want any clinical advice. I'm very, very happy to help. So I would like to thank you for sticking with me through the presentation. Hopefully you've got to the end and you've got some useful information there. I'd like to thank my colleagues for providing material and also some really, really useful links here, particularly SCAP, which is a great organisation, will give you some really practical advice about how to get the best out of your worming regimes, both for lungworm and other roundworms and other parasites, and also a little bit here about the papers that I've written about lungworm. So I am most willing to take any questions. I think we do have one question already, which is, we are a practice in the Western Isles with no foxes on the island. How high is our risk of avizorum? Well, in that case, I think the risk is very low because you won't have a wildlife reservoir, presumably. So even if you have a dog coming to the island with angius jugulus visorum, it's unlikely to be become endemic on your island because you don't have the wildlife reservoir. So I think risk in that situation is very, very low. And I think that's why we should take a risk-based approach to anthelmintics. So yes, I've never in fact realised that before. So I think your problem is going to be much more from ticks and ectoparasites than from lungworm. But certainly I can also talk to Eric Morgan about that and see, we could always test some slugs and snails from the Western Isles to see if you do in fact have any disease up there. But I would have thought risk is very, very low in that circumstance. At this point, there are no more questions. I'd like to ask a question to anyone out there, whether anyone knows if they've ever used albendazole in canine patients before. I don't know if anyone has. If they have, be great to know, because it's something I could put into my presentations for future for treating. So we've got quite a few no's. So that would be if we're wanting to treat filariasis hearthi, people saying nope, not got albendazole out there, so you would have to use an off-licensed cattle or sheep preparation. So I'm very, very grateful for everyone for sticking with us.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Jenny for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.